call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. We have some unfinished business from last time when we ran over, partly because we started late because of the late arrival of so many members of the committee, and I wish to point out today that we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to be starting on time. If you're not here, you're not here. But I have asked our legislative assistant to note in the minutes times of arrival and departure. So if you want to make that part of your record in the committee, that will be fine. We do have, as I mentioned, unfinished business from the last session, which would be the testimony that we had arranged from CenterPoint Energy. Mr. Dougherty, I believe, is still here, and while he's coming to the table, Representative Falk, if you had reviewed the minutes from last time, would you be willing to move their approval?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move approval of the minutes from the Monday, January 20th, or the, which was the, excuse me, which was the last date we had, Mr. Booth? The 21st. Wednesday, 21st.
Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of their approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Mr. Dougherty.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee, and please accept our apologies for dragging you here last week for no particular purpose.
No, I understand. No problem, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, representatives. My name is Jeff Dougherty. I'm a director of regulatory and legislative activities for CenterPoint Energy's Minnesota gas operations. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'll be speaking from a PowerPoint presentation that I've been told is in your package. And what we were asked to do, Mr. Chairman, is to provide a background on the natural gas business in Minnesota. So what I propose to do is speak just briefly to the natural gas delivery process, give you some Minnesota-specific facts, and share with you some of the more significant industry issues that we're dealing with. On slide three is just a schematic of the natural gas delivery process. It really isn't that complex. We start the wellhead where the supplies are. We deliver it through the interstate pipelines to the natural gas LDCs and then to our consumers. And I'll address each of these areas just briefly. On the supply side, probably goes without saying that there is no native natural gas supply in Minnesota. And so for us in Minnesota, we receive our natural gas supplies from the southern United States, Canada, and western United States. On page 5, table 5, you'll see a map of the continental United States where the major basins are, and it also shows the flows of natural gas. For us in Minnesota, we get most of our natural gas from the Permian Basin, which is in southwestern Texas, the Anadarko Basin, which is in the Panhandle area of Oklahoma and Texas, and from Alberta. Regarding the supplies of natural gas, I also shared with you what three notable organizations indicated as the amount of recoverable resource in the United States. And if you do the math, the recoverable resource is there for over a period of 60 to 70 years. The gentleman who testified last week from Northern Natural shared with you a similar type of map, similar type of information. And I think looking at that map together with these will give you a more complete picture. Not all supply basins are the same. And I think that map that the gentleman from Northern shared with you would indicate that. On slide number 7, move to interstate pipelines. The job of interstate pipelines is to deliver the gas from the supply basin to the local distribution companies. They are regulated by the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. There are four main pipelines delivering gas to Minnesota: Northern Natural, Great Lakes, Viking, and Northern Border. On slide 8 is another map of the continental United States, and it shows you the major interstate pipelines in the United States, and you can see where they're aggregated, where the majority of the supply is. On number 9 is a map of the United States that shows with you where the major pipelines are, coming into the state of Minnesota. The one that I haven't addressed is Alliance Pipeline. Alliance Pipeline does not stop in Minnesota. It goes through Minnesota. It has what's called dense gas. It's delivered from Alberta, Chicago, where they strip the natural gas and the propane out. As far as the natural gas distribution business, it's commonly your utility companies here in the state. Our job is to take the gas off the interstate pipelines and deliver it to folks' homes. There are six investor-owned utilities in the state of Minnesota. We are regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission as our primary regulator on our rate matters. The Department of Commerce, they regulate us, participate in our rate regulatory matters, but they also regulate our conservation programs. The Office of Energy, Office of Attorney General's Office participates in our rate regulatory matters, and we're also regulated by the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety. There are 33 publicly owned natural gas companies in Minnesota. What we all have in common is that we all acquire natural gas supplies, arrange for interstate pipeline transportation, build main services and meters in the state, bill customers, and maintain the system. On slide 11, shares with you the six investor-owned utilities in the state of Minnesota and gives you the major community that they serve. Unlike electric companies, natural gas utilities have non-exclusive franchises. If you're interested in more of the entire service territory of these natural gas companies, I'm sure they can give you a more complete picture of their entire service territory. I've also listed for your information the publicly owned gas utilities. You can see where they're located. Slide 13, just give this to you to give you scope. 95% of the customers and throughput in the state of Minnesota are by the investor-owned natural gas utilities. As far as taking a look at ourselves compared to the rest of the nation, I thought I'd give you that just briefly. We use 1.5% of the natural gas that's consumed in the United States. This is based on 2005 statistics. If you take a look at on page 15, comparing ourselves to the rest of the country, our customer dynamics are similar. We have about 90% of the customers in the United States are residential customers, and in Minnesota it's about the same. However, how the gas consumed is a little bit different. In Minnesota, most of the gas that's consumed is used by commercial industrial customers. In the United States, most of the gas is consumed by commercial industrial customers and electric generation. If you take a look at our typical revenues in the state of Minnesota, about 75% of our revenue dollar is for the cost of commodity and the distribution cost to get it from the supply area to Minnesota. That's governed by the purchase gas adjustment. About 25% of our revenue dollars are distribution margin, and that's what's regulated through a general rate case proceeding in front of the Public Utilities Commission. I'd like to share with you just two of the more major and significant issues that we're dealing with in our industry. The first is on page 18, and that illustrates to you the volatility of natural gas. I've been at the natural gas utility since 1986, and I think that this is the single most item that has impacted our business above any other, and that is the variability and the overall level of cost of natural gas. It makes it very difficult to purchase natural gas. It makes it very difficult to educate our consumers on what the prices they can expect to be on a natural gas. It also can make it very difficult for some of our customers to pay their bills.
Doctor, what explains that?
Excuse me?
What explains the volatility?
I think that there are several things, and maybe the best way, Mr. Chairman, is to give you an illustration where we were this past summer to where we are today. This past summer, we were sharing with our customers, that they could anticipate natural gas prices to be 40% higher than they were the season before. As we all know, that's dropped quite a bit since then. That's a good thing. The reason for this is several things. First, why the price weakened. And it was really unusual when you look back at last summer that there were adequate supplies of natural gas in inventory. We were at a five-year average. And so it was really unexplainable because the technical side just didn't explain the fundamental side. You know, it appears that there's gas there, but gas is trading higher. I think what happened is what we've seen with the economy, it weakened, so that we got even more supplies on. I think there's a lot of debate right now about the role of speculation in our industry. There are those that debate that there's a bubble, if you would, of speculation in the oil and natural gas business, and those monies have moved aside and now are out of the commodities market. I think also that we've had a fair amount of, we're starting to see the impact of Rockies gas coming into our market. So I think that all explains it. I think that in the long run, the converse of this is what should we expect going forward. I think that that as we move into the next several years, as the economy strengthens, I think we're going to see more pressure on natural gas prices to go back up. Part of the reason for that is rig counts are down from where they were, down about 17% where they were last summer. What happens when prices are high, people go out and drill for natural gas. They're not drilling any longer for natural gas. And as those reserves come down and the industry comes back in this country, they'll put increased pressure on natural gas prices and drive them back up. And I think the other thing can give us added prices going back up in the future is that some of these pipelines are coming out of the Rockies into our area, will progress further east, and they'll start competing in the eastern part of the United States market. And where prices are higher, people are going to pay more, and pass our market, and our prices will go up. On page 19, I've just given you just a picture of something that we've realized in our industry for some time now, and that is that residential customers are consuming less of our product. I mentioned to you earlier, I started the gas company in 1986. At that time, our customer used about 130 decatherms of gas per customer. Today, they're using the mid-90s. That's about a 2% decline per year. To help put this in context for you, the bottom in the last graph on page 20, comparing 1997 to 2007, we've added over 142,000 customers to CenterPoint Energy's business in Minnesota. Most all of those are in the residential and small business sector. Since then, our distribution margin for that same class has held basically flat. So for 10 years, our throughput for our largest segment of customers has not changed. In the meantime, we've invested over $440 million in the state of Minnesota. Now, we have an obligation to serve customers as they come on, and that's what we do. But it should be no surprise that why we have to come back in for general rate increases when customers aren't consuming as much of our product, yet we have an obligation to serve them. So I just wanted to share that information with you as well. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have. I'm available for questions.
One question occurs to me, Mr. Dougherty, regarding that last point that you made. What explains the drop in consumption? Is that largely due to efficiency measures, or are people finding some alternative? What's the explanation?
Mr. Chairman, I think there are several things. It's more of the first item you touched on, that's efficiencies. First off, it's building codes. I think have had a significant impact in the state of Minnesota. If we take a look, for instance, my house was built back in the 60s, and it was built out 2x4 construction. Most new construction today is 2x6 construction, much better insulation. So I think that's one item. The second item is that when customers' furnaces that are 30 years old, 40 years old are coming off, they can't buy the lower level efficiency furnaces that they had originally in their houses today. You automatically have to upgrade to a higher efficiency furnaces and products. And certainly then just the overall conservation measures that we're doing in the state of Minnesota. I think all of those items contribute to that.
Thank you. Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dougherty, on page 18, the graph that you show the volatility, do you take any measures to try to restrain the volatility? Do you have a hedge strategy or any other measures that you take to try to even that out a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we do. We do hedge our gas supply portfolio. We do that in several ways. We do have inventories of natural gas that we take advantage of, but then we also take strategies to hedge our portfolio. And we hedge somewhere in the neighborhood of about 40% of our portfolio a year. But that, what that does is the volatility of some years, I mean, what we try to do is we're trying to reduce that volatility. Some years you have years where it spikes up and you have years where it drops, and so that's a very difficult thing to manage.
And Mr. Chair, that was actually my follow-up question. Is it working?
Mr. Dockery.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have reduced volatility. Sometimes it's nice to behold in hindsight whether you should have hedged as much or not hedged as much, simply because of, you know, just the hindsight review of what would have happened if you didn't do something. But our strategy has reduced volatility.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the same lines, I was just noticing on the graph, it seemed to be from 1993 until about 2000 or there shortly after, it was pretty flat. What's the big change in the last 8-9 years?
Mr. Dockery?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, I'm harking back off memory because I'm getting a little foggy myself through these years. When I first started the gas company, they talked about a huge gas bubble that was out there, more supply than demand. I was thinking about this morning, trying to harken back to 2000, what really tripped that, and I just can't remember, but I will go back and get back to you on that.
Thanks.
Further questions? Seeing none, Mr. Dockery, thank you. Again, let me apologize for having you have to come back today, but we appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll be seeing more of you as we go forward. Thank you, Pat. Thanks. Commissioner Wilson. Members, we've asked the Department of Commerce, whose budget we have in our finance division, to do a couple of things. Both give us kind of an overview of what they're up to and how they're managing or not to comply with their mission and goals, and also to get into questions of the upcoming budget. And that will, of course, be a continuing discussion on which we will have some additional light shed tomorrow. Commissioner Wilson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Hildy, and members. Certainly appreciate the opportunity very often on this kind of a meeting. This is my seventh year. We're given about 10, 15 minutes and have a very broad department, so appreciate the patience of the committee and you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us the time today. I would be remiss if I didn't note, since this is an energy committee also, that our Stay Warm Minnesota website was... The website was put together by CenterPoint Energy. We put the information together, and they were extremely helpful, so I wanted to make a note of that. Secondly, I wanted to mention that John Gross and Pat Sexton are probably well known to most of the members of the committee, and John Gross has been with the state and our department for many, many years, more than three decades, and provides outstanding help to the department on the health issues, and of course Pat Sexton on government affairs has been with a number of administrations, and appreciate his sound advice. When you come into a position such as mine, it's hard to tell sometimes what to expect in terms of the employees, their background, etc. And I can tell you that first off, that I've been not surprised. I didn't know really what to expect as a business guy with 45 years, but I can tell you that that the department is populated by people that are dedicated, hardworking, and well-educated, and I've been very pleased with the sound advice that and the breadth of the knowledge of the people in the department There are 63 of the 317 employees that we have advanced degrees. And so when I ask for advice and counsel or come up before your committee, we have engineers, mathematicians, actuaries, historians, and 20-some lawyers, so that the expertise is not only broad in terms of their experience, many with 20 and 30 years, but also their education backgrounds is very supportive. Within the departments, in the last couple of years, we've added 13 systems, and our number of employees has stayed pretty steady around 313 to 320, today 317, and we've put in 13 systems to help with the efficiency overall of the department in that regard. And when it comes to the budget, I don't want to diminish the fact that that we are very strong in terms of our budget oversight, management oversight, but the truth is that we're less than 1% of all other. And so when you look at the department's budget, much of it is financed by the utility industry, the finance industry that we audit or work for, work with, but also the federal government and other sources. So when it all boils down to our department budget, it is 9/10 of 1% of all others. So in terms of the overall budget, we're fortunate to have the opportunity, frankly, to raise or the revenue is about 5-1 over our expense. So with that, I'd like to introduce Tim Jockey, who's the financial whiz for our department. Is 12 years with the state in the finance area, but numerous departments before coming to the Commerce Department 3 years ago. Tim?
Good afternoon, committee. My name is Tim Janke. I'm the budget director for the department. I'm going to walk through a few slides here that give kind of the overall agency budget. And as others come up later, they'll have some slides that are more kind of dive down a little bit deeper into the individual divisions of the department. Just want to note that these numbers that are presented here are base budget numbers, and obviously we'll have some updating to do tomorrow, so we can work with fiscal staff on that. And in addition, the numbers here include the Office of Energy Security, which I understand will be on Wednesday. We'll have that, but these are just kind of the overall budget. This first slide is for the expenditures by program area for 2011. Obviously, you can see from here that the Office of Energy Security is the vast portion of our budget. The expenditures that are here total about $553 million, $380 of which are for the LIHEAP program, low-income heating program. So that's the vast majority. Those are federal funds, and for the most part, they're all passed through dollars.
Mr. Jackie, in this slide, is there a distinction made between federal and state funds, or is there lumped together?
Chairman, not in this slide. The next slide will have it. This is all funds right here. So this is federal, general, special revenue, all of our funding types.
Thank you.
Move on to the next slide. Then this graph represents spending by fund across program areas, so it kind of flips that just to what your question was. The expenditures by fund, obviously because of the LIHEAP program here and the discussion we had with energy security, are the bulk of the funding as well. So about 74% is for the is federal funds. In addition to the LIHEAP funding that I mentioned, we also receive a fair amount, about $8 to $10 million a year for the weatherization program, that is just federal funding. The next largest area on the slide here is the special revenue fund. The expenditures in this area include programs, the insurance fraud prevention program, auto theft prevention, telecom access from Minnesota, or the TAM program, as well as weights and measures. So So that those are the bigger programs that make up that 12%. The general fund, we won't talk too much about now. We'll get into that a little bit later. The petrol fund is about 6%. The largest portion of that is we estimate about $15 million a year in reimbursements, so we've averaged a little under that. And again, we'll get into the details of that a little bit later. And then we have a couple of small, we have a direct appropriation in the workers' compensation, out of the workers' compensation fund, of about $835,000 a year. And then a small bit of agency in the agency fund, which is when the courts place funds in receivership from companies, we take control of those monies and then distribute them to the individuals that were harmed. And we have just a little bit of money that we're expecting to carry over into the new biennium. Move on to the next slide here. This is a graph that represents represents all funds or all revenue for the coming biennium. For 10 and 11, as an agency, this is across all funds, we're expecting to receive just under $687 million. The two pieces of the pie on the left side, the general and petrol fund, are non-dedicated revenue. Petrol fund is the bulk of that is interest on the existing balance. Within the general fund, we have about $213 million that we're expecting, and those are broken down in the box there in the lower left. The bigger areas, and then we have some multiple areas. The unclaimed property is about $69.5 million, and that's net of funds that we've returned to the rightful owners. Securities registration, this is the mutual fund cap that was removed the last session. We're expecting to receive about $74 million for that. That cap had been set at 25, and then it had been bumped up to, I believe, 25.6, and then it was removed. And licensing, we expect to receive about 25.5, and then all other. All other includes a number of different areas in the general fund. It includes financial institutions, the assessments that they do in the banking and insurance area, utility assessments for energy companies, telephone, telecom companies, fines, penalties that are in the market assurance area, as well as weights and measures inspection fees.
Before you leave that, I think Representative Kalin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Janke, can you elaborate just a little bit more on the nature of the unclaimed property and the, as well as the reliability of that figure from year to year?
Mr. Janke, Chair Hilty, Representative Kalin. The money from unclaimed property has stayed fairly stable the last 2 years. About 3 or 4 years ago, there was a demutualization of insurance companies that caused a pretty good spike in that. Well, there's a slide later in the presentation, we'll get to that, but I believe we received in excess of $100 million in 1 year from that. But it has been pretty stable around the $35 million for the last couple of years. And even prior to the demutualization, it had been right around that number, maybe a little bit smaller.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, Mr. Janke, in the third grade language, can you tell me what the unclaimed property is?
Chair Hilton, Representative Kalin. These are properties that have, if a company has issued a check to you and you have not cashed that check, after 3 years, they report that to the state as unclaimed property. We deposit that in the general fund, publish your name, try and get that word out, and then have you submit a claim to us, and we would get that money to you.
Just one final follow-up. I appreciate your patience, Mr. Chair. Are we talking about a lot of small checks and assets, or are they often very large in the six and seven figures?
Mr. Shankin.
Chair Hilty, Representative Kalin. Periodically, we will get some larger claims. bigger ones usually are in the, you know, maybe $30,000 to $40,000 range. I mean, we may have some on the books that are larger, but it is generally a lot of smaller items, under $100.
Thank you, Chair.
The right side of the chart here in the darker blue is our dedicated revenue portion, about almost $472 million. This includes, again, the biggest piece is our federal funds, about $407-408 million we're expecting in 10 and 11, as well as special revenue funds. Those special revenue funds support those activities I had mentioned earlier, and then we have some small, the agency fund, and then we generally get some small gift monies for, usually for low-income feeding programs that we get out to folks. On to the last slide here from my section. This is just to give a kind of an overall view across the agency, across funds, across programs. The bottom portion of it here, and it doesn't show up very well, but I guess it does up there. It's in the darker gray on the bottom is the general fund. We're expecting revenue in the general fund of just over $200 million. For the biennium, expenditures are going to be in the $44 to $45 million range, and the top portion is all other funds. So if you look at it in total, we estimate that the department is going to produce about $687 million in revenue and spend about $533 million in the coming biennium. In addition, there's another source, or there's other funding that is a direct link to our department, and it's the insurance premium tax that's collected by revenue. And in fiscal year 8, revenue collected about $285 million in the general fund and $346 million total for the insurance premium tax. That's the end of my prepared information. If there's questions, otherwise I'll turn it back to the commissioner.
Are there questions at this time? Thank you, Mr. Janke.
Mr. Chairman, while Manny Munson-Regala is coming up, I'll introduce him briefly. Manny has a good number of years of experience in the insurance industry, had been with Travelers for some period of time. When we hired him, he had been at United Health and has been with our department for the past year, doing an outstanding job, and we're pleased to have Manny with us today.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for having me. My name is Manny Munson-Regala. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Market Assurance Division of the department. First slide talks about how we spend our money. Things to note, and we'll have copies of these slides for you. Roughly 60% or so of our expenditures go towards investigations or enforcement. Next slide shows you where we get our dose by, or how we spend our dose by funding. We're probably the one division in commerce that gets a lot of money from general. In essence, market assurance has a number of missions. First, we enforce compliance and reasonable business conduct across all the industries we regulate, roughly 20 or so. We provide assistance to consumers in their business transactions. We're sort of the consumer help desk for many consumers and industries we regulate. We review insurance policies and rates, and we register the securities sold in Minnesota, sort of the product review side of our house. And lastly, we license business and individuals according to Minnesota statutes. On the licensing side, we license over 200,000 individuals on an annual basis. Roughly 105,000 of them are insurance producers. Interestingly, that's a 25,000 increase in the last 2 years. The other noteworthy thing about our insurance producers is that when we first started licensing insurance producers electronically roughly 7 years ago, the split between residents and non-residents was 55% residents, 45% non-residents. The new 105, the split is now 43% residents, 57% non-residents. So definitely more non-resident.
Mr. Munson-Regala, could you elaborate on the definition of insurance producers, please?
Those are agents, brokers, any folks that are involved in the solicitation or procurement of an insurance product. We also licensed over 27,000 real estate brokers and agents. I suspect when I see that number go down. And roughly, we have to approve and review continuing ed in most of our licenses that we look at. About 850 approved education sponsors, and we review 22,000 approved courses a year. The bulk of this work is done electronically. We've included a number of systems and applications funded primarily by a technology surcharge that our licensees take.
For a moment, Representative Beard, you had a question?
I do about this point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I know you've been trying to bring the course approvals into the 21st century, but over the past couple of years, I've had two continuing ed providers who have been complaining to me that course approvals are just stuck in the mud. Now, I haven't heard from them for 3 or 4 weeks now. Can you tell me, are things getting better? How are we doing with this?
I will say,
Mr. Gale.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are working on a number of proposals that will be part of our licensing bill we'll introduce relative to streamlining some of the consumer education process to go through. A lot of it will be conformity and uniformity measures, and I look forward to explaining this bill when we're ready to present it to Representative Atkins' committee.
Related to that, sir, do you guys handle barbers and cosmetologists also in your department, or is that someone else thing?
Chairman, Representative, we do not handle them anymore.
All right, thanks.
In addition to the licensing work we do, we also handle consumer assistance. We took roughly 25,000 calls in fiscal year 2008 from consumers. The bulk of them, almost 19,000, were insurance-related. A lot of the calls are education, you know, what's in my policy, how do I read this provision, what goes into a renewal, what goes into premium. Given the number of industries you regulate, we also receive roughly 6,300 other calls. Sometimes the calls will result in formal investigative files we open. And in fiscal year 2008, we opened over 6,700 formal investigative files. So I'll talk a little bit about the evolution in what we're seeing in these investigative files over the last few years. Lastly, and the pictures illustrate this is after Hugo, we provide on-site assistance after storm, helping folks with insurance claims, understanding their policies, understanding how they interact with public adjusters, or what public adjusters can do for them. That sort of basic consumer education. This slide shows recoveries. Recoveries are defined as additional monies we could collect for consumers as a result of our action. So, for example, if an insurance company made an offer to settle a claim for $1,000 and the final resolution after we got involved was $2,000, we would charge a $1,000 recovery. You'll note there are two big spikes in 2003 and 2006. Those reflect class action settlements we obtain on behalf of consumers, remediation done with companies to make offers of restitution to consumers. In addition to these charts, our criminal enforcement matters also result in restitution to victims. In 2007, we got about $3 million in restitution for victims, and in 2008, our cases generated $2.6 million in restitution.
Before we stray too far from the question of the 18,000 calls, do you keep track of the resolution of those calls? Are they all resolved to the satisfaction of the caller? Or what's the record in there?
I would say that the majority of calls, roughly 60%, are education only. The ones where there's some matter involved, we don't do a consumer satisfaction survey, but we do track whether or not the fine is generated as a result. I can do more follow-up in sort of how many of the files result in recoveries or additional payments, but I don't know if we don't track consumer satisfaction at that time.
Sure.
Representative Atkins.
Commissioner, on the last slide that you had up, you had the two spikes, but the trend seemed to be roughly downwards. I think if you were to draw that line that reflects the, is there any basis for that, or is that just everybody's getting to be good, honest citizens and resolving their claims appropriately, or what would you attribute it to?
Commissioner? Thank you, Chairman. Chairman Representative Atkins, I believe that reflects in part the industries have a better understanding of what we expect from them in terms of their consumer behavior. So we're doing a good job of educating the industries who regulate as to what we expect from them relative to claims handling. That would be our assumption in terms of what we're getting with respect to recovery. In the area of enforcement, we generated in fiscal year 08, $2.6 million in civil fines and penalties, reflecting, again, our perhaps a blunt form of education. We took 423 enforcement actions, 183 insurance, 55 mortgage, real estate, appraiser. That can range from revocation, censure, fine, penalties. The biggest change in the nature of the files we're looking at is that when the commissioner first started at Commerce, a lot of the work we worked on involved civil discipline, a revocation, a penalty, a censure. Now we're seeing more and more criminal matters. For example, on a yearly basis, we used to do 2 to 3 referrals to criminal authorities for prosecution. We're averaging about one a week now, criminal matters that we're taking in. We have currently roughly 70 open files across all of my different units linked to active criminal investigations. And just in mortgage alone, we have 300 mortgage files of the roughly 1,600 that have some allegations of fraud. Whether or not that will result in criminal behavior, we don't know, but that's the kind of behavior we're looking at. So we've made the transition from a civil disciplinary authority to more of a white-collar crime unit in some respects.
Commissioner, what initiates those investigations? How does that work? What happens?
I'll be covering that in a later slide, but in essence, we'll receive a referral from a number of different sources, federal law enforcement, including other agencies like DALI, or from the agreed victims themselves, or from other industry members. We'll initiate the initial review, and I'll talk about some of the tools we do. Sometimes we find out that in the course of our investigation, there's already an active criminal investigation going on, and then we'll hook up with the criminal authorities and work in tandem with them to be sure that our investigation doesn't screw up a criminal matter. Because while we're interested in yanking their license, we also want to make sure that they're not around to continue their behavior elsewhere.
Thank you.
Example of a typical investigative matter, and this is actually, I call it typical because there's a kind of material we get under normal circumstances, but it can sometimes involve behavior that you don't normally think of as falling under Commerce's watch. And this is an investigation of illegal sales practices by bail bondsmen. Bail bonds are sureties and IE and insurance products, which is why we managed to have involvement in this matter. We have a short video to play talking about our involvement.
Could you guys just act it out, maybe?
Thank you. Don't set of rules, even its own economy, but this? At first glance, you might think it's a bank. There is a cash machine in the lobby.
You hear all kinds of crazy things that do happen in this business.
Or judging by its conservative design...
It's a different type of animal that we're dealing with.
It could easily pass as an insurance company.
I have never come across it.
Upon further review...
That's what really threw up the red flag.
You can see it's neither.
2300, I'm going to be bringing two people back into the booking room.
We've all heard how life behind bars has its own set of rules. Even its own economy. But this?
They are acting as insurance agents, but without a license.
Who in the world would recruit jail inmates to sell insurance?
I had never heard of the man before.
The man's name is Timothy Hansen. His company is Greater Midwest Insurance Agency, and besides offering to sell you coverage for your life, car, and home, he wants to help you get out of jail.
Bail bonds are insurance products.
Dropping in trouble at work or with friends.
What better place to find customers who need bail than this joint, the county jail in Brainerd? According to investigators, Hansen hooked up with several inmates to do a little suggestive marketing on his behalf to the newly arrested.
They were slipping cards under doors. They were confronting these other inmates.
Hansen's operatives were giving out handmade cards like this. For every new bond customer referred to Hansen, Danny got a nice little kickback.
Between $25 and $50.
Apparently the bail business is highly competitive. Bondsmen have been known to get into courthouse fistfights over customers.
In a business like this, when one business is bad, everybody's bad.
When Kurt Scheinman got a tip that one of his competitors was paying inmates to drum up business, he did what any member of the Better Business Bureau would do. He alerted the authorities.
To find the inmates who were getting the kickbacks, all investigators had to do was follow the money.
Inmates aren't allowed to use cash when they're locked up, but they can have a kind of jailhouse debit card to buy snacks and things. Anyone can deposit money into an inmate's account by using this machine in the lobby. Investigators zeroed in on the accounts that were getting an unusual number of deposits.
They left us a nice paper trail,
which led them to Timothy Hansen. State regulators stripped Hansen of his license to sell bail bonds and slapped him with a $10,000 penalty. He declined to comment for this story. This may not be the last we hear of a Minnesota insurance company setting up shop in a cell block. The Commerce Department says more crackdowns are in the works. Jeff Belly in Fox 9 News, Brainerd.
In addition to our typical investigative matters, we also work on a number of complex cases. Two tools for our complex investigative work. First one is our market conduct unit. These are senior investigators using outside consultants, contractors, working on the practices of insurance companies in this case that span a number of underwriting and rating practices. We've evolved from looking at fairly traditional vanilla practice market conduct exams that used to be regularly scheduled. We now do them on a targeted basis. We now do them in conjunction with other states. We have a number of multi-state exams going on. They can take several years, and they're highly focused on relevant behavior. In addition to our market conduct team, we have an insurance fraud unit. Their jurisdiction is insurance cases. Now a number of criminal enterprises. They have roughly 250 open investigations, the majority of which involve some degree of involvement with multiple defendants. About half the unit are licensed police officers. I won't go through detailed investigative techniques, but you will probably not be surprised to see a lot of them feel like the kind of investigative techniques you use in criminal investigation. I'm going to talk a little bit about one example of some of the work our fraud unit is doing. We had a chiropractor who moved in from out of town, and he was having trouble finding patients for his clinic. In order to drum up business, he hired a number of runners to find patients, and they targeted the immigrant community to find those patients. They go to soccer fields or parks and offer folks $100 willing to go to the clinic. Once they would get there, they would find that there was a stage accident in the parking lot. They could claim that they were part of the accident. The patients were able to claim injuries. They would get paid in cash, and then the clinic would start billing the insurance company for workers' compensation or other treatments. Our folks conducted surveillance, could identify employees, patients, found a second chiropractic clinic where this work was going on. We looked at databases to confirm ownership, licenses, identify the insurance claims by clinic. We looked at the claims, confirmed that there was in fact insurance fraud. It was reasonably easy in some respect because the guy was billing for work when he was out of town. So. Conducted victim witness interviews. And then we took a deposition from the chiropractor. One of the things about white-collar crime is that we're not surprised to find that oftentimes when you conduct an interview of the potential defendant, that they will confess. And we've made a referral for this matter for criminal prosecution. Now, on the market conduct, let me talk about a typical market conduct, some of the things we're looking at here. We recently settled with Physicians Mutual. We allege that they engaged in unsuitable sales practices in a number of products, annuities, long-term care, and MedSup. We also allege that they were involved in the improper replacement of existing products and that some of the marketing material was misleading. They were fined $375,000, and they promised that they would stop doing business in Minnesota until they could get our permission, which is becoming more and more a common element of our consent orders that we enter into companies, with companies. The commissioner, I believe, was the first Commerce Commissioner to bar companies from doing continued business in the state as part of consent orders. And they have to go through with a restitution plan with their policyholders. Our market conduct team is currently looking at exams in the following areas: title, mortgage insurance, particularly the area of kickbacks, suitability, are sales being made with the right products to the right folks. We're looking at some workers' compensation. In particular, we're engaged in a large multi-state market conduct exam of the AIG companies. Our market conduct team also has the folks that do collection agencies, and they right now have 5 or 6 collection agencies in receivership. What occurred in those cases is the collection agencies collected money from debtors on behalf of creditors and kept the money for themselves. So both the creditors and the debtors were screwed in the process. One of the things we've been focusing on, and the nature of our work is requiring us to do, is our work is requiring us to get all of the disciplines in my division involved and in Kevin Murphy's division involved in coordination on looking at these large complex files. For example, in the mortgage title fraud cases, it will involve both licensed and unlicensed persons. Here's a list of the type of licenses that may be involved in a mortgage fraud file. We'll also look at unlicensed individuals such as builders who are licensed by the Department of Labor and Industry. This is a chart that, again, is going to be part of materials. This gives you a typical example of a typical mortgage fraud case, a builder bailout. We have a builder with excess inventory. In order for him or her to sell his excess inventory, they have to figure out a way to inflate values and come up with ways to get the inventory off the books. We recently did a builder bailout investigation that I'll close with a video to show you that. It involved 22 commerce investigators and analysts from our real estate team, our insurance team, and our fraud unit. They executed 11 search warrants, roughly 170 or so bankers' boxes, numerous computers, bank records. 5 police agencies were involved in our execution of the search warrants. And we have a short story to show you that investigation.
Real estate and insurance investigators who worked together. And when they went out to bust what's called a builder bailout, they gave the Fox 9 investigators exclusive access.
Nine raids, six counties in 2 days. A good indication of the scope of the alleged scheme, not just in dollars.
Millions of dollars in real estate, over $1 million in kickbacks.
But in depth.
The whole real estate transaction is a fraudulent transaction.
The Fox 9 investigators watched as state investigators with the Department of Commerce waged an evidence-gathering campaign.
Real estate closing documents, all of the paperwork, bank account information.
That swept through a high-buck house in Golden Valley to a condo in Shoreview. The state says some of the players in the scheme lived in these places.
We feared that if we didn't move fast, we would lose the rest of the information.
You would think documents might be destroyed.
Sure.
Documents by the van load seized from a lending company called Assured Financial in Little Canada.
No comment.
Workers weren't talking. The home of the president of the finance company hit in the raids too. Also, the home of the builder. And it's with the builder, the state says, the whole mortgage fraud scheme began.
The new sophistication of the fraud is that everybody at the table is involved.
So sophisticated, a forensics IT expert will have to unravel all the computer evidence. Investigators call the scheme a builder bailout. Here's how it works. It begins when a builder builds too many houses or townhouses. If he can't sell the homes, he can't pay off his construction loan, and he's got a problem.
They're losing money, so they need to move them off their books.
Investigators say this house is a good example. The appraiser, according to the state, inflates the value of the house by $57,000. The appraiser then earns his fee. A real estate agent knowingly lists the home at the inflated price. Then the state says the construction lender, a mortgage originator, and the builder recruit what's called a straw buyer. They put money in the straw buyer's account and put false information on his loan application so he qualifies for financing. Investigators say this man, who showed up at his home when it was being raided, falsified at least 37 mortgage applications for straw buyers as part of this scheme. But why would a straw buyer play along?
We're going to get you some real estate, no money down. You're going to hold it for a while. We're going to rent the property out, find some renters. The value's going to go up, and you're going to sell it in a couple of years. It's going to be a great deal for you.
A bank issues a loan for the house based on the fraudulent information. Then a title company, state investigators say, closes the deal knowing it's fraudulent. The sale goes through, and the players split the extra $57,000. Remember, that's the amount the house is overvalued.
Everybody gets a little kickback.
Except the bank.
The loser here is the lender.
The problem is, the builder or construction lender never helps the buyer find a renter. The house is so overvalued, the buyer can't get out from underwater and can't sell it. He likely never makes the payment. The bank never gets a dime. The house goes into foreclosure. And remember, in this case, it's not just this house. Investigators say it happened 44 times, with homes ranging from values of $235,000 to nearly $500,000.
If the lending institutions are being defrauded and are losing millions of dollars on loans, they're going to pass that loss on to us. Our rates are going to go up.
And the values of the neighborhoods are going down. Foreclosures and fraud experts say account for a good part of what we've come to know as the mortgage mess.
The only person implicated in this alleged scheme who would talk with us is the builder. He told me by phone, quote, "I know I didn't commit a crime, and I believe the records will show that." Chris Van Pilsen for the Fox 9 Investigators.
And we do have a question or two, Representative Faulks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, are some of these schemes brought to your attention through whistleblowers? Or is this, what is the primary mechanism of discovering?
We receive reports from whistleblowers, from law enforcement. Sometimes the straw buyers themselves will come to us and complain that they got less than a fellow straw buyer, not understanding that. So we get our tips from a number of different places.
Just follow up on that.
Representative Falk.
Has there ever been any use of a Federal False Claims Act or in proceedings like this? I mean, where a government might have, or is this strictly private business entity where there's not government money really at stake?
Chairman, Representative,
Commissioner,
we are working with a number of federal agencies, including the IRS, HUD, USPS, IRS. I don't know if any of them would have alleged that sort of claim, but we haven't used that tool.
Okay. Just one of the things that I'm also seeing is taking some precedence in the state is the implementation of the Minnesota False Claims Act, and I was wondering if that would potentially be a useful tool in helping to combat some of these frauds, but we could talk about that at another time too. So,
Chairman, members of the committee, that's my presentation. If anyone has questions about my division.
Representative Beard.
A quick question, Mr. Munson Regala. This particular one we just saw, I know the builder said he didn't think he committed a crime. It appears to me that laws already on the books were sufficient to trigger the investigation, the seizures, and all that stuff. Has this been come to trial yet? Has there been a crime proved, or how are we doing with that?
Commissioner Munson-McGall.
Chairman of Representatives, we conducted the searches in November, so we're still in the process of doing our investigation.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, while we're switching, I'd like to introduce the next speaker. But to answer your question, we've had a lot of these come in through a wide variety, but we are getting convictions. We've had over 15 actually sentenced. The one in Parrish case where we helped the FBI and other federal agencies, there's been three. The builder got 13 years, his wife 3, and the son 8. And we have three more in that case to go. The two appraisers and a realtor. So that gives you a little bit better flavor. Mr. Chair, I'd like at this time to introduce Kevin Murphy. Kevin's been with the department for over 10 years as the head of the finance and the audit area. But before that had been 17 years with the federal government doing like work at federal banks, and during that time has managed some of the field staff as he does now. So, Kevin.
Deputy Commissioner Murphy, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Kevin Murphy, like Commissioner Wilson said, I've been at the Commerce Department for 10 years. I began my career with 17 years with the FDIC, and after the FDIC, I was in the private sector doing consulting work for 12 years, so a fair amount of experience in this world. Let's see if I can get my slides to play here. It's a little bit like walking and chewing gum at the same time. There we are. Now, what we basically do is we license and regulate banks, credit unions, finance companies, insurance companies. We want to have numerous choices for consumers and businesses. We also license mortgage companies, check cashers, payday lenders, and money transmitters and the like. We have two big goals in our world. We want to have a very competitive marketplace for financial services with lots of choices for businesses and consumers. And on the other side, we want to have minimal failures. So those two goals kind of conflict, and our job is to strike the balance somewhere in the middle. Some of the highlights of, over the last couple of years, we've licensed 155 new insurers to operate in Minnesota since 2005. We've approved 21 new state banks since 2003. We've had no failures of state banks, credit unions, or insurance companies in recent history. We began the examination program for mortgage companies in 2008. That's just getting off the ground. And with respect to insurance companies, Minnesota is the nationwide leader in the transition to what we call risk-focused insurance company regulation. Insurance company regulation 10 years ago was pretty much a repeat of what the CPA firms did. A lot of bean counting and not all that much analysis. We've shifted the focus there to deal much more with the areas of risk in the insurance world and not have it be repetitive of what the accountants do. Our division is fairly unique in the state government in that we collect back nearly all the money that we spend. The money that you appropriate to us, we collect that back that money from the regulated industries in the form of examination fees, application fees, and assessments. And our goal generally is to break even. So we're not a drain on the state resources. Little slide here on our overview of our budget. About almost $10 million per year. Most of it is general fund money, which pays for the Commerce Department staff for the most part. The special revenue of $3 million and change represents that we hire contractors to examine the bigger insurance companies, and that's sort of a pass-through. The reason we do that is that the insurance exam workload is very uneven. We'll have a year where we have a lot of work, and then the next year we might not have very much, and trying to staff up internally for a very uneven workload would be very economic. Also, some of the insurance companies are extremely large and extremely complicated and sophisticated, and frankly, we're not able to hire at state wage levels the kind of talent that we need to do a respectable job on examining the insurance companies. And of course, the companies pay the price for those examinations, and the rest of the country relies on Minnesota to examine the companies that are headquartered here. So our view is that if we are going to do it, we should do a good job at it. So that's why there's that big special revenue item in there. This slide shows that we spend about half of our money on insurance regulation and the other half on banks and credit unions. We have two separate pieces to my division. One we refer to as the banking side, and the other is the insurance side. I'll talk a little bit about the banking side first, but I'm assisted by two excellent and experienced assistant commissioners, Bill Horlitz on the banking side, who's an FDIC alum, Jackie Gardner on the insurance side, who has worked in two other states, and she's one of the leaders in insurance regulation in the whole country, for that matter. Some of the components we regulate in the banking side are 323 state banks, 96 credit unions, 183 consumer credit finance companies. We license 1,200 mortgage companies. We license these currency exchange or check cashing places. And we also license the money transmitters. We have about 67 staff, and about two-thirds of those work on the banking side, and most of the time there is spent on banks and credit unions. We do on-site exams of banks and credit unions on a 12 to 18-month cycle. We also monitor the condition of banks and credit unions, reviewing quarterly financial data on an ongoing basis. For the state banks, we have what's called a divided exam program with our federal counterparts, specifically the FDIC, and we share information with them, share technology with them. We take turns conducting exams. We'll do one exam, and then they'll do the next one. And if it's a bigger bank or a troubled bank, we tend to do those together, so we have a lot of cooperation with the federal counterparts. Bank exams are very thorough. They involve a review for compliance, but also a lot of time spent on loan portfolios, which is the area of the biggest profit and biggest risk for the banking community. We produce written exam reports, which are provided to the bank and also to the federal counterparts. With respect to the credit unions, we do most of the exams with some assistance from the federal counterpart, the National Credit Union Administration. On finance companies, we visit them also on an 18 to 24 month cycle, and that's strictly a compliance exam where we check for violations of law. Usually these exams result in refunds to consumers from overcharges. Our exam program for mortgage companies is just getting started. It's only staffed by one person at this point. We've had to build that from scratch. It's taken a little bit longer than what we anticipated, but we have a very exceptional person heading up that effort. Dan Mitchell, and his background includes 20 years as a police detective, 10 years running a mortgage company, and he served as the, I think, the president of the Mortgage Trade Association for a while, and he taught compliance classes for the industry. So we needed somebody very experienced in the inner workings of the mortgage world. For trying to transform him into an examiner is taking more time than both he and I expected, but a very talented person, so we're pleased with the developments in that world. The exam reports that are generated for all of these entities are confidential and not publicly available. Typically, they have a lot of detailed information on bank customers in there, and there's just no, would be no point served by making those public.
Commissioner, you have a question, Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm noticing that absent from that list, along the lines of the wire transfer companies, is payday lenders. Does your office oversee and regulate payday lenders, or does anybody?
Commissioner Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that payday lenders, I believe, are included in with the finance company. And we do license delayed payday lenders.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, if you could just confirm that for me and not necessarily right now, but just sometime at your early convenience, but not earliest, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Lester.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, question I had from a constituent, and I don't know the answer, and you might know the answer. Does Minnesota require private lenders or a private loan such arrangement to be licensed? Dealt with this person's business, or when they borrow money to somebody that, or would borrow money to companies that have accounts receivable, and I understand that they call it factoring. Is that something you regulate in Minnesota, or is that just a private contract between parties if they do it?
Commissioner Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that type of a transaction is a commercial transaction, which is generally not regulated in Minnesota.
Okay.
We have another slide here dealing with the shape of the state banks and credit unions. Most of the banks and credit unions are pretty healthy, but we are seeing some marked deterioration in bank and credit union loan portfolios. We maintain a watch list for banks. We have a rating system for banks, and it's 1 through 5. 1 is very good, 2 is good, 3 is fair, and 4 and 5 are less than satisfactory. And I'll on occasion talk publicly about the status or the watch list, so we don't identify specific banks on this list. But anyway, currently we have about 50 state banks in our watch list, and 34 of those are in the 3 category, the fair category, and 16 are in the 4 and 5 category, which is a little bit more troublesome. This list is almost double from 26 back in June of 07. So in 18 months, the number of watch list banks has doubled. It's about 15% of the state banks are on the watch list. Of those 50, 22 are in the Twin Cities metro area, 27 are out of state. I guess the unusual development recently is having so many metro area banks on the watch list. It used to be that most of the watch list banks would be smaller, struggling outstate banks, but that's pretty much changed the last couple of years.
Just a second. Commissioner Representative Welty, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I was told by some individuals I know who work in state banks that they have seen more regulators come into the bank, and they've seen the presence increase. And so I'm just wondering, with the statistics that you're outlining right now, is that a direct correlation because you're stepping up enforcement, you're stepping up regulation in the state banks, and you're stepping up your presence? Can you tell me, like, over the last couple of years since we've really seen this financial crisis take off, if your department has had an increased presence in the banks, and that's part of why we're seeing more banks on that watch list?
Mr. Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, kind of a lot of variables in the answer to that, but the troubled banks get examined more frequently, so it's a bit of a punishment to have the examiners in and out of there more frequently. But I'd say we're pretty much keeping up with the exam schedule. We have statutory requirements. Sometimes if we have a troubled bank, we will go in together with the feds. We have, you know, fairly limited resources, and we have 330 banks, so we don't get there too often.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, it goes back to the beginning, and I'm trying to understand throughout the presentation when you talk about your goals at the beginning. With your part of the Commerce Department, and one is kind of helping banks and financial institutions be created, and one is make sure that they don't go away. And I'm curious where in your goals, if it's not in this part of the Commerce Department, if it's in another part, where the consumer protection or making sure that with the fraud, and we're seeing a lot of that, you know, we saw that in the last presentation, but I'm also curious if it's part of your goals or what you do.
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's one of the ultimate consumer protections is to make sure that the consumer's money is safe in banks and credit unions. And that's a real bedrock issue that we deal with. And a lot of people take that for granted when times are booming, but when things get a little bit bumpy, that gets quite a bit more important. A lot of the abusive transactions take place in either in finance companies or in the mortgage arena. The most of the mortgage investigations are handled by Manny Munson's division. Our division deals more with banks and credit unions and a much lower level of consumer complaints in those industries. They tend to be a little bit more respectable. We do recover a significant amount from finance companies for overcharges of consumers, so that's an area where we've been pretty successful in several years.
Representative Knuth.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a quick follow-up, and Mr. Murphy, trying to, as we go through our budget process this year, I think again and again we're going to be coming back to what the goals of our agencies and our departments are, and I think from what it sounds like, you are doing consumer protection and making sure people are, their money is protected and they're not being overcharged and all of those sorts of things. And I think the more explicit we can be in our, in the goals of that, I think would be useful on the legislative end as we try to go through budgets and the oversight and see what our agencies are doing.
The Representative Philip Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I have had some reports of lenders who have already been through foreclosure and now are the fee owner again of the home, and they are reselling, insisting on particular title companies for the buyer, which I think is a RESPA violation. And I'm wondering if you've heard of that, or if these might be just isolated incidents.
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Wilson has offered to field that one.
Commissioner Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. In the title area, we have had a significant number of investigations, and many are ongoing. As an example, a year ago, one of our investigations shut down 37 sham operations, and there were 80 people involved, and we followed up with many of those with heavy fines. I think several of the fines were over $500,000, but they're ongoing, and this is a significant area. A lot of the shams were paid to realtors and mortgage bankers for referrals, but many are organized where major builders and major realtors have sham operations where there's reinsurance money being passed back. So yes, we have a good number of investigations continuing in that area.
And perhaps I wasn't clear, not that the title company is doing anything that's a sham, only the steering by a financial institution. I'm talking about the original lender, be it a bank, for instance, who is now foreclosed and is reselling. In fact, I've seen purchase agreements where they will insist that the buyer, the new buyer, go to a particular title company, and my understanding is that's a violation of RESPA, and I'm wondering if you've seen that. So it would be the financial institution illegally steering.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the same situation. We do investigate those, and we do take actions on them. The difference between an affiliated organization and where there's an illegal path back is a pretty fine line, but we investigate a lot of those calls.
Thank you. Members, we're just about out of time. We will ask the Deputy Commissioner Murphy to conclude this presentation, and we'll take up with the Telecom Division in the next meeting if they're able to come back. Commissioner Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, you want me to continue?
Please.
I'll try to boil this down a little bit for you. Now, let's talk a little bit about the safety net for depository institutions. Bank deposits and credit union deposits are both insured by federal agencies up to $250,000 per account now. The FDIC covers banks, the NCUA covers credit unions. There's a lot of money being thrown around in Washington to try to rescue the banking system. Most consumers are not at risk. We've not had any state bank fail in a long time. We did have one federally chartered bank fail in Staples, Minnesota earlier this year. That bank was taken over by the FDIC and immediately merged into a North Dakota bank. A pretty seamless transaction with no losses to consumers. Nationwide, there were 28 bank failures in 08 and 3 so far this year. When I worked for the FDIC, one of my jobs was to arrange the mergers of failing banks, so I know that, I know my way around that environment. Hopefully we won't have too many here. Thought I'd talk a little bit about the insurance segment of our division. We have another slide here. An insurance regulation is quite a bit different from banking regulation, especially in that there is no federal regulator of insurance. The 50 states are responsible for insurance regulation, and we work through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is a mechanism for exchange of information between the states, and also they come up with model laws for the states to adopt. You can see in our slide here, we have in Minnesota, we call Minnesota domestic companies, and domestic means companies headquartered in Minnesota, like Minnesota Life or Allianz or companies like that. So there's 32 Minnesota life and health companies and 47 property and casualty companies for a total of 79 Minnesota companies. We also have 87 smaller Minnesota Township Mutuals, which provides fire insurance out in the countryside. Then we have 1,200 and some so-called foreign companies that are licensed in Minnesota. They're not really foreign, but companies that are headquartered in other states, like Northwestern Mutual in Wisconsin is licensed to operate in Minnesota, and State Farm, for example, an Illinois company that operates in Minnesota. So we have 400 and some life and health companies and another 800 property casualty companies. So Minnesota is responsible primarily for those 79 domestic Minnesota companies. So we conduct on-site exams of those companies on a, generally on a five-year cycle. We can do it sooner if necessary. We have a three-year cycle for health companies and HMOs. A big difference between bank regulation and insurance regulation is the exam reports for insurance companies are public. Those get posted on our commerce webpage. And we also do an ongoing review of these so-called foreign companies. We depend heavily on the state where they're headquartered to be the primary regulator, but we're also looking over their shoulder. We want to have a lot of competition, a lot of providers, but we don't want too many of those to fail because that's inconvenient for our citizens. We do have a watch list for insurance companies, especially the domestic companies. We accord those a little bit more attention. We have probably a dozen companies on the watch list now, about 15% of the total, and mostly smaller companies, and none are in what I would call the danger zone. For the foreign companies, we participate in the National Association of Insurance Commissioners working group that continuously monitors the financial condition of bigger troubled companies nationwide. Assistant Commissioner Jackie Gardner is very active in that group, so we're pretty much up to speed on that. As far as the safety net for the insurance world, we have two guarantee funds that are overseen by the Commerce Department. We have a guarantee fund that covers life companies, and there's a separate one that covers the property and casualty companies. Both of those operate on an assessment basis. They pass the hat if there's a failure, and you know, make it good to the consumer. It's a a little bit like the FDIC, but FDIC is a prepaid fund. They already have billions of dollars there, where the guarantee funds don't have the money. They collect it as needed. As far as the coverage for a consumer, the cash value of an insurance company is covered by the guarantee fund up to $130,000. That's indexed to inflation, and death benefits from life insurance policies and annuity policies in the payout stage are covered up to $410,000. And I believe that we're the only company that has that inflation escalation in the amount of the safety net coverage. As far as the condition of the insurance industry, it's kind of all over the place. It's hard to generalize. The bigger property casualty companies, homeowner insurance, auto insurance, those are doing pretty well. That's a pretty stable and predictable business. They're, of course, susceptible to weather-related losses, hail and hurricane, and unemployment, foreclosures, arson. Those are all factors. Unemployment affects workers' comp claims, and there are, of course, fraudulent issues at work there also. As far as the life and health company, it's hard to generalize in that arena. The great life insurance business is pretty stable and fairly predictable. There are some issues related to what they call stranger-owned life insurance, which is a little bit like speculating on a human life, which is generally considered to be bad form, but there is a fair amount of that, and there's some fraud involved in that arena, and there'll probably be some legislation coming before the legislature this session. Some of the annuity providers are a bit of a concern as far as financial condition. A lot of providers sell so-called variable annuities, which are linked to stock market indexes. But the stock market has gotten killed in the last year, and a lot of these annuity contracts have a guaranteed interest rate built into them. So where the offsetting investments have gotten creamed, companies have these guarantees that they still have to honor. So some of those companies are getting squeezed a little bit. The industry is pressuring the NAIC to now liberalize some of the reserving requirements, and those are currently under discussion. That concludes my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Members, we are out of time. Deputy Commissioner Murphy, there may well be questions that we don't have time to entertain today. If it's at all possible, we'd appreciate if you could come back on Wednesday, and maybe we can give members an opportunity to ask questions. I think that this division is one that is very important to a lot of our considerations, and if that would be possible, we'd appreciate that.
I will try to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Members, with that, we are adjourned.